Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Earlier this month, state transportation officials announced they will tear down the aging Casey overpass in Jamaica Plain and replace it with an at-grade interchange conducive to walking and biking. The hulking elevated mini-highway is a lingering vestige of an era when the car was king in Boston. Back then, the mantra was build it up, build it wide with multiple lanes.
Consider I-695, also known as the Inner Belt. It was a proposed 8-lane superhighway that would have cut through Roxbury, the Fenway, across the river, and then straight through Cambridgeport and Somerville on its way to I-93. For example, in Cambridge, where the Middle East nightclub and restaurant stands now in Central Square, there would have instead been a highway the size of the Mass Pike.
Opposition to the plan grew through the 1960s, but the Inner Belt had many powerful proponents, not the least of whom was former Massachusetts Governor John Volpe, who became Richard Nixon's Secretary of Transportation. But in February of 1970, Volpe's successor, Governor Frank Sargent, went on television and announced a moratorium on all new highway construction within Route 128.
We've built more and more and bigger and better superhighways and expressways. They seem the easiest, the most obvious answer to our multiplying needs. What we misunderstood was what those highways would create: massive traffic congestion. You, your family, your neighbors have become caught in a system that's fouled our air, ravaged our cities, choked our economy, and frustrated every single one of us.
By putting the brakes on the Inner Belt, Sargent was forfeiting billions of federal dollars, alienating powerful construction and business lobbies, not to mention many suburban voters who wanted more and faster ways to get in and out of the city.
Sargent's decision and the events leading up to it are now considered a watershed moment for city planning, and the legacy extends far beyond the neighborhoods that were spared the wrecking ball. That legacy is the subject of a series of programs from the Cambridge Historical Society that will run through April, and two of the people involved in those programs join us right now. Tunney Lee is a senior lecturer and professor emeritus at MIT, where he used to head the Department of Urban Studies and Planning. He was involved with the Inner Belt first in the 1960s at the Boston Redevelopment Authority, and later provided technical assistance to the neighborhood groups that united to fight the highway. And Tunney Lee, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Also with us is Jack Wofford. He directed the Urban Legal Studies program at Harvard Law School in the 1960s and then headed a task force established by Governor Sargent to reconsider the Boston area highway plans. He went on to serve in Jimmy Carter's transportation department and now owns a mediation and arbitration firm in Cambridge. Jack Wofford, great to have you.
Thank you for being inviting me.
Well, it's my pleasure. And Tunney Lee, let's start with you. You have a great story about the day that you decided to help fight the Inner Belt. And I understand that it starts with a car ride you took with former State Transportation Secretary Fred Salvucci, who was then working with you at the BRA at the time, right?
That's right. We have been looking at the Inner Belt portion of the Boston portion of the Inner Belt, and that seemed to be a fixed thing. But then as we looked at the map as it went through Cambridge, we thought we better take a ride and see what was being considered there. And we were just absolutely appalled at what kind of housing and how many people would be displaced by that highway.
Because you went through some vibrant neighborhoods and saw what
yes.
would essentially what the wrecking ball would be knocking down.
Right. Cambridgeport, you know, Brookline Street. And if you go through Brookline Street today, you just can't imagine anybody would even think of doing that.
Hmm.
And crossing Central Square, as you said, there would have been an 8-lane highway going about where the Middle East is now. And then really trying to tear down everything sort of on Elm Street all the way to Somerville.
And we should point out that much of the route for the Inner Belt was, in fact, cleared, right, before the project was killed?
That was in Boston.
Yeah.
The Boston portion, a good part of it, not the whole thing, but a good part of it had been cleared, but it had deteriorated to the point where it was less of a controversy. The controversy is really where it went through the museum, right by the Museum of Fine Arts and the Fenway.
Well, I want to get to, you know, what this said about the way we thought about urban development and how to get people in and out of cities and what we learned. But first, Jack Wofford, let me come to you. The Inner Belt was just one component of a regional highway plan adopted in 1948. Can you run through some of the other plans that didn't come to be?
Sure. I think you can think about it as a wheel with spokes and the Inner Belt at the center. So the Turnpike was built in the 50s and early 60s. The Southeast Expressway already existed. But the plan was to extend Route 2, if you can believe it, from Alewife in to join the Inner Belt, build a Southwest Expressway that was an extension of I-95 coming up from Providence in to join the Inner Belt, and then a tunnel under the harbor that would hook up with I-95 north that would then go to 128 and join I-95 on its way to Maine. So the interstate system, I-95 in particular, was this concept of a Maine to Florida expressway. And key to the Boston issues was that it was going to go right through the center of Boston, but in a kind of loop-de-loop arrangement of joining this circular connection of the central artery and the Inner Belt.
It almost sounds like the city and those who lived in the city was sort of an afterthought. I mean, when we hear about it described today.
Well, you know, values were changing
sure.
at that time. I directed the restudy that the governor imposed as a result of putting the moratorium on it, because the moratorium didn't cancel the highways. It said we're going to suspend planning for them and look at both highway and transit options, pluses and minuses, existing plans, new plans, and come out of it with a new approach. And of course, he came out not just with deciding to kill most of the highways, but with an emphasis on preserving and enhancing the access to downtown by public transportation.
Well, I'm interested in who opposed it and how they won this this great day. But first, who are the proponents, Tunney Lee? Who are the major proponents of the Inner Beltway?
Well, I think it was, first of all, the state government with the federal money. In Cambridge, it was certainly the Cambridge establishment. So, you know, the first proposal for the Inner Belt through Cambridge was down Lee Street, which was just too close to Harvard, and that was quietly squashed. And the other alternative was closer to MIT, and that was loudly squashed. And what was left was the poorest people, the most powerless people, same in Roxbury. And who was for it was, at one point, the Cambridge Civic Association, even the League of Women Voters, the Cambridge Planning Board, the Cambridge Redevelopment Authority, the Chamber of Commerce, all the kind of forces arrayed against it.
Sure. And Jack Wofford, there were some unexpected proponents. I understand you remember an interesting conversation with a particular Cambridge city official about this, right?
I do. You know, we were getting the restudy going and looking at the Inner Belt, and I was neutral. I had no commitments as to outcome. My job was to create a fair, open, transparent process that looked at all the alternatives. And in the course of getting it started, why the director of planning for the city of Cambridge, who shall be nameless at the moment.
No, he's not. Alan McLennan.
So much for namelessness.
Came to me and said, you know, the opponents of this are just behind the times. He said that three-deckers are a thing of the past. This highway is just going to go through a bunch of three-deckers, and who cares? And I was interested that in the Globe on, I think it was Sunday,
this is just recent. Yeah, there's
city
a new
moves to preserve iconic three-deckers, you know. I
right,
brought the clipping. So
there's now city money to save these three-deckers as a sort of reminder of the way things used to be.
Yeah, values were in the midst of changing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's an important point in what Tunney is describing, that none of these entities, City of Boston, City of Cambridge, were monolithic. there were divisions, splits within each of them, that, and including within the Sargent administration, that had to get played out for the ultimate result.
Well, the successful effort to oppose the Inner Belt brought together an unlikely coalition, right? An unlikely coalition of constituencies. Who came together to fight this highway, Tony?
Well, I think at this point, the what came to be the Urban Planning Aid, the Cambridge Committee for the Inner Belt, was Bob Goodman, Fred Savucci, and several others who appeared at the scene at the time that the citizens' groups were forming in St. Mary's Parish, others. And getting together meant that they were given technical assistance in instead of just being opposed, which you could characterize as just obstructionists. They were challenging the models, they're challenging the assumptions, and they're challenging the logic and the professional aspects of the study. So that came together. City Council had always been opposed.
Yep.
And then they enlisted and swayed a lot of civic organizations onto their side. And eventually, the congressional delegation was very important. Tip O'Neill eventually came over to the side. So it was a matter of coalition building coming out of this combination of now organized citizens' groups with technical assistance.
And when Governor Sargent, Jack Wofford, when Governor Sargent finally makes this announcement and says there's going to be a moratorium and we're going to study this longer, and he essentially ended this, how unusual was that? I mean, this didn't happen every day that a governor would go up against the Federal Department of Transportation and say this ain't happening.
It was dramatically revolutionary, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, prior to the moratorium, the governor had created a blue ribbon task force to advise him on these controversies. We reported to him the last week of December of 1969, recommending the moratorium. It then took till the following February to impose it, because he was risking $1 billion worth of highway aid at a time when there was 14% unemployment in the construction industry. The same week that our task force reported to Governor Sargent, the United States Congress enacted the National Environmental Policy Act called NEPA. So there was an amazing coincidence, confluence, that reflected a really major change in values.
Well, listeners, we're talking about Boston's Inner Belt, the highway that never was, an 8-lane superhighway that would have cut through Cambridge, Brookline, the Fenway, Somerville, Roxbury, but it fell to community opposition in the 60s and the 70s. What has Boston learned since then? Is that a lesson? Was there a lesson about the limits of big highways, or was that the way to go? Do you remember the Inner Belt? Were you on one side or the other of this debate? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And we've already got a listener on the line. Let's go to Caleb, who's calling from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Caleb.
Hi. I wanted to thank your guests very much for their efforts in combating what, at least from the dimensions you're outlining of the project, would have been just unbelievably horrendous type of highway intrusion. So that's hats off to them. But I'm wondering about the larger debate, which, you know, actually spans a century almost, between highway hawks and what I call rail revolutionaries. And I'm just going to read a very short quote from the from an article called The General Motors Streetcar Conspiracy, which says, quote, "By the time of the 1973 oil crisis, controversial new testimony was presented to the United States Senate inquiry into the causes of the decline of streetcar systems in the United States. This alleged that there was a wider conspiracy by GM in particular to destroy effective public transport systems in order to increase the sales of automobiles, and that this was implemented with great effect to the detriment of many cities." Now, that those claims aside, I just wondered, what's their opinion of how, you know, this debate in urban planning has played out in the Boston area, and their opinions on the current MBTA showdown.
All right, Caleb, I appreciate the call. This sort of leads me to a question that I want to ask. And let me start with you, Jack Wofford. I mean, this decision was to sort of say no to the car in a way and save the neighborhoods. But did we say yes to the alternatives? Have we said yes in a big way to the alternatives, be it light rail or even the Green Line extension, whatever it is?
Well, we did in a big way. Frank Sargent made a big decision when he decided not to build Interbelt Southwest Expressway I-95 North. When he went on statewide TV, and this goes to your listener's question, he said, not only are we not going to build those highways, but we are going to build transit extensions. And to do that, I'm going to Washington to change federal law so that we can take some of the highway gas tax money and use it for transit. There was an outpouring of interest from metropolitan areas around the country to what was originally called the Boston Provision. And amazingly, it was enacted in the 1974 Federal Aid to Highway Act called the Interstate Transfer Provision. So it was that $1 billion that Sargent put at risk that was used to extend the Red Line from Harvard Square, where it then ended, out to Alewife through Porter and Davis Squares, was used to relocate the Orange Line from Washington Street to the Amtrak rail corridor, as well as the extension of the Red Line from Quincy Center to Braintree.
Oh, I see.
So there
really
was definitely not only say no to something, but say yes to something. And an interesting point about Jamaica Plain is that the opponents of the Southwest Expressway knew that if the governor was confronted with just a build or no build decision, it was bound to lead to a build pressure.
So there had to be something in place of
and there's
no
something
build.
Had to be something in yeah. place, and what was put in place mm-hmm. was the Southwest Corridor Park that is now a prize-winning park used by all kinds of pedestrians, bikers, everything else, as well as the industrial commercial development road, Melnikas Boulevard. The right-of-way had been already acquired about 90% through the whole Southwest Corridor and much of the Inner Belt in Boston. And so it was necessary to give the governor an option where, yes, there's something you can build.
I see. Let's go to Ellen, who's calling from Somerville. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
I wanted to say that as a Somerville resident, I'm very happy that the Interbelt was not built, but we're still dealing with that in Somerville because they did raise the area of what we call Interbelt in Somerville to build the highway, and we're hoping to have economic development there, but we're still dealing with the state not wanting to take the McCarthy overpass down on McGrath Highway, unlike they have agreed to do in Jamaica Plain.
You're talking about the McGrath O'Brien overpass there in East Somerville, correct?
Right, right. Yeah. That goes in right around Washington Street, and there is a de-elevation study going on, but they are claiming that they need to repair the bridge, which means that it'll be in operating for at least 15 more years. And we're saying, you know, time to take it down.
Well, Ellen, let me put the issue that you raise is an interesting one, and Tunney Lee, let me ask you that. I mean, are we still dealing with the sort of legacy of the Inner Belt planning in other parts of the city?
Well, I think there's sort of fragments, and one of the things that was proposed that the Inner Belt was supposed to do was to take people around the city, and what those cities and towns are more the working class communities. And there was a inner ring proposal mm-hmm. to build transit, and that's proven to be very, very difficult. But pieces and bits of it have been put in place. But I would say most of the old highway stuff, except for remnants like that, have been put to rest.
Well, I appreciate Ellen's call. I know that part of Somerville well. I live not far from that overpass, and it does continue to be a part of the city that a lot of folks who live around there would like to see improved in a way. Jack Wofford, did this defeat of the Inner Beltway, did it help provoke changes that rippled out from Boston and went across the country in a way, this moving away from the car is king idea?
I guess I'd have to say yes and no to that. Mm. Even in the Boston area, if you look at the development around Route 495, well, first around 128 and then 495, the automobile continues to have a major role to play. I think what this restudy did and the governor's decisions, along with issues that emerged in New York City over Westway, in San Francisco over the Embarcadero Freeway, in Seattle over I-90, at the other end of I-90 from our end, emphasized that our dense urban centers are something different, mm-hmm. and they need to be enhanced and preserved, and public transportation is the best way to get in and out of those, whether it's special lanes for buses or rail transit or commuter rail or whatever the modal technology, and that the automobile is not king with respect to dense urban areas.
And Tony Lee, and I think I know how you would answer this, would anything have been better if that thing had been built?
No, nothing.
In a word, nothing. Okay.
It was so much worse that it wasn't really that anything could have been better. It's just, no.
Well, thank you both coming in. Fascinating bit of history. Interesting to talk about it and consider the what the city would have looked like had it been built. Tony Lee, senior lecturer and professor emeritus at MIT. He's the former head of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
And Jack Wofford directed the Urban Legal Studies program at Harvard Law School in the 1960s. He headed a task force established by Governor Sargent to reconsider the Boston area highway plans. Jack Wofford, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The Inner Belt and the successful fight to keep it from being built is the subject of a series of April programs from the Cambridge Historical Society involving our two guests and among many others. You can find more details at radioboston.org. Stay with us. We've got a lot more coming up. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.